Hello everyone, welcome to the second podcast in our series, and this podcast is all about what is learning. So there is a reason why I'm starting with the topic of what is learning. So when I was reading through one of the coaching and mentoring books I'm going to share on a reading list, they actually suggested to begin with talking about learning instead of talking about mentoring and coaching strategies. And effectively, when you think about it, this is the key focus of our apprentices, the mix between learning in the workplace and learning in university. And as an educational scientist, I also think if we begin with understanding learning aspects and dimensions of learning, this will enable us to make more informed decisions about the appropriate coaching and mentoring strategies. So before we explore models of coaching and models of mentoring and all the different questions you ask in conversations, I thought creating a foundation for exploring these will be much more useful in the long run. So it will contextualize anything else we are looking into, and it will provide a framework we can refer to throughout the course. So how do we actually learn? I came up with a definition a while ago. So learning is the dichotomy of the sense-making process between socially mediated, extrinsic, external, and individual, intrinsic, internal activity. This creative, social, as well as personal process can to a certain extent be mediated by the social environment, yet it consists of internal processes whose direction might not be influenced, predictable, or even understood. So, if you wish to pause the podcast for a moment, I'm going to pose a reflective question. And this is a question I use quite often in teaching new lecturers or our graduate apprentices. This is the question. Think back to a positive learning experience. What happened? Did anyone help you? Did anything help you? And most importantly, was it easy or did you have to overcome an obstacle? So I venture a guess that a learning experience that came to mind was unlikely something that went without a hitch, but more likely something that cost you some effort, that was a challenge. I'm regularly posing this question, and normally in seminars or workshops, a common theme is that of overcoming an obstacle, and quite often also being supported by guidance, or it is characterized by perseverance. And this is what I'm talking about when I'm talking about a positive learning experience. These do not refer to avoiding challenges or avoiding cognitive dissonance, but they are situations within which the learner is able to have agency, to take control and ownership of the learning process. So what does this mean? If you don't know the term cognitive dissonance, this is a feeling of psychological discomfort which occurs when a person's beliefs, values, or ideas are confronted with beliefs, values, or ideas that contradict or stand in contrast with their own. This can happen regularly in learning situations. When I'm teaching, I often actually aim to create a little bit of cognitive dissonance to challenge my learners, to engage, to question their beliefs or their ideas. So the issue arises is the following. The greater the personal value of the elements of the held beliefs, the values, ideas, the greater is the magnitude of the dissonance. So the more investment someone has in their beliefs, in their values, the worse is the dissonance for them. This is important when we are thinking about learners becoming defensive in a learning situation. There can be a multitude of factors, but cognitive dissonance here can explain defensiveness in two ways. In one, if the learner has a strong connection between their self-image or their self-worth and the held beliefs and ideas that are challenged, then they can feel personally challenged by the learning. So if the dissonance is too great, the learners might not know how to reconcile their own identity, their own perspective with a new one. So as an example, you know, you've probably heard about the flat earth movement, right? And flat earthers have expanded vast amount of energy to create so-called evidence to make themselves believe the earth is flat. If they are now exposed to overwhelming contrary evidence, this poses a risk to their self-image. So they rather become defensive and entirely ignore the facts provided to protect their identity negotiation and self-image. Now, mind you, learning is not always that volatile. However, more subtle forms of this principle can occur. For instance, and we talk about this a little bit later, if certain behaviors are learned by one of your apprentices and you are asked them to change the behavior to adapt to company culture, depending on how strongly their identity is linked to some of these behaviors, that can cause quite strong friction when they are asked to change the behavior in a new context. So I hope this example helps you a little bit to see how or why learning is also described as identity negotiation. To summarize, so a good learning experience, if you wish, comes from overcoming the challenge, from developing strategies, learning strategies and approaches of how to break down problems, solve a problem, how to get there in the end. And it's not about not falling flat on your face on the way. This can happen, and this is part of the process. In fact, one of the things we try to achieve in our courses is to create a safe space for failure, for failing forward, which means that if a student fails an assessment or an exam, or they fail to understand something, they learn that this is part of their learning process and that this is okay. It's okay to not get everything right from the get-go. And what is important is how they continue from there. So in your role, you will basically enable your learners to take the ownership and control of that process, to identify how to move forward and to have agency. And we will explore in a later podcast some techniques or mechanisms of how you can do that. Now back to the aspects of learning. So cognitive dissonance is a principle from psychology, which is one of the four lenses through which we explore learning and teaching. Psychology is such a complex field that educational psychology is a discipline in her own right. However, education also draws from developmental and social psychology. Next to cognitive dissonance, models we can draw from to understand our learners, for instance, are self-efficacy, motivation, confidence. There are models of intelligence. Just be careful with the actual intelligence tests because their quality and reliability varies widely. However, if you are interested in models of intelligence, Howard Gardner's work, which I will link to in the handbook, about multiple intelligences is really interesting, has a big body of research behind it, and also his writing is actually really accessible, so it's something that is a joy to read, at least for me anyway, but it's well written and it's really accessible, so it's something interesting to have a look in if you're interested in multiple intelligences. So next to the psychological lens, we can also explore learning from a sociological perspective. For the purpose of this podcast, I limit this to introduction into looking from a social perspective, because again, sociology is a massive discipline in their own right. The social environment has a significant impact on our learners, so peer pressure is real. As an example, when I was teaching in another institution, I was still teaching students, and my colleagues and I encountered a whole first year group, and I think this was about 100 students, using referencing wrongly, which cost them all 10% of their grade marks. Independently, my colleagues and I tried to find out where the students got that wrong information from, and eventually had a chat with a student representative, who was a very assertive and outspoken student who had misunderstood the instructions from the lecture. And despite me showing a detailed referencing guide with the explanations, remember cognitive dissonance? The student insisted this is exactly what the professor has said. So, I called my colleague and I told him about this. Needless to say, they were rather bemused by the whole issue and told me later they rectified the instructions in a subsequent lecture. And we also ran a referencing session with these students. And despite all of this, it was really, really hard to convince the students that we as academics were right and their student rep was wrong. So peer pressure can have a really strong impact on your learners, so keep this in mind. If there is a strange myth making the rounds, if you have a cohort of apprentices, it might just be because someone who is quite respected within the group of apprentices got something wrong and that spread. So the social environment does not only consist of peer pressure. Some of your apprentices will have all kinds of demands on their lives, as you know, that can impact their learning, such as families or caring responsibilities. So their social environment is also where their norms, values and attitudes were shaped. Some of you in the sessions we've had so far and in interviews were talking about behavior at the workplace, such as the use of mobile phones, communication, politeness. All these are learned behaviors and often are context dependent. So communicating your expectations around these is really key when your apprentices start. We tend to become quite disgruntled if someone breaks our unwritten rules. And just last week, for instance, on Twitter, there was a big debate in the German-English Twitterverse about the formal address we are using in Germany. And it's mainly used in the workplace and educational environments. And the discussion on Twitter was fairly heated and varied in terms of people associating it with respect, boundaries, feeling valued, using it for closeness and distance. So if we come from an assumption that our apprentices do not know the unwritten rules and we clearly communicate these, we can save ourselves quite a bit of hassle. What I find sometimes difficult though is to anticipate what needs to be communicated. So you all seem to have agreed on the use of mobile phones for instance, or the use of language in emails, or being willing and able to contribute to discussions. However, has any one of you ever been forbidden to make coffee in an office because you broke the rules of how many spoons of coffee go into an industrial-sized machine? Yep, that happened to me. What I want to say with this is we are all institutionalized in our own organizational environment. So we might not necessarily be aware of everything that needs to be communicated until we actually get to a point of friction. So just be aware that an apparent wrong or offense very likely comes more from not knowing the unwritten rules than from malicious intent. And as a German, I can really vouch for that because it took me a really long while to write emails that were not perceived as rude or aggressive. Just because we have a much more direct approach to communication than is normal for a British context. So we have looked at learning from a social and a psychological lens, but we can also look from a personal lens. I think one of the questions that links best to this lens was that came up in one of the sessions was, what happens if a mentor and mentee just don't click or can't get on with one another? And we had discussions about making that a non-punitive part of the mentoring process, where you are able to switch mentors if it doesn't work out, because effectively it is about the best experience for the mentee and for the mentor. And we will look into how to lead difficult conversations in another podcast and maybe have a chat with your colleagues or your team and your company how you actually approach to enable a mentor swap without making it something personal. So in another podcast, I will address introvert and extrovert learners as well and some learning disabilities that might, without being aware of a diagnosis, express themselves either as extreme introversion or extroversion. And we will look into learning strategies that support all learners. So the personal lens for learning can have to do with learner preferences. And here I'm not talking about the type of learning styles you may have been exposed to in school, such as auditory or visual learner, because there is no body of proof or scientific evidence that these actually exist as they are described in the model. However, it doesn't mean that our learners aren't different and have different needs. So you might find someone needs complete silence to be able to focus. There are other learners who constantly need music or audiobooks or films in the background. Some people need more hand-holding, instructions, regular check-ins, while other learners are happy to just get on their own and prefer to just check in when they are stuck. These preferences can also have to do with your learner self-efficacy we talked about earlier on. Now, another reason learners might disengage is if they are feeling overwhelmed or under-challenged. The feeling of overwhelm can come from cognitive dissonance, but it can also come from the lack of trust in one's own ability to solve a problem, from a lack of confidence in that. So depending on your learner's internal monologue, this lack of confidence could lead to disengagement. So I undertook a small research project in a school of computing science with students who had to repeat a year. And when I was speaking to students about their failures or their fear of failure, they explained their internal reasoning as such. So if I don't engage and I don't understand something, then I didn't understand it because I didn't engage, not because I'm stupid. However, if I would engage and do not understand it, then I just get a confirmation that my fears about me being stupid are actually true. So their fear of failure basically prevents them from engaging, because this way they can try to keep their identity, remember the identity negotiation of not being stupid upright, they can keep that identity negotiation of I'm not stupid up, because they think if they would apply themselves, it would just prove that they are stupid. So that's what they've told me. And so I think how we can help learners like this is with scaffolding, with guiding them through that process and guiding them through a process of learning how to solve problems. And there are a couple of structures of how you, or instructions, and I have a handout somewhere which I can share with you as well. It's like how you can help someone to come up with a problem-solving strategy. However, the opposite end of these students is students that are under-challenged. So while students with low self-efficacy and low confidence will often see challenges as a threat, students with high confidence, with high self-efficacy, will see challenges not just as an opportunity, but actually as fun. So you will have learners who actually enjoy being challenged. Now, if you try to break everything down based on just your learners with low self-efficacy, then your learners with high self-efficacy and confidence will not feel challenged enough, and they might get disengaged because they get bored. So, as you can see, it's quite a big gap to bridge. And some of the key principles you could use, for instance, is if there's a very clear process, if there's very clear guidance of expectations of what should be achieved by when, that will help the independent learners to just use this as a reference point and check in with themselves, and they can go on in their own time, while the learners with lower self-efficacy can use this to scaffold and support their approach to learning, and then you have also something you can discuss with them. So this is just a rough strategy you can use, and clear communication about expectations is fundamental for learners, and also to show them how something fits into the bigger picture. So when they're working on something, on a small project, on a bit of code, how does this fit into the overall picture of what they are doing? So that relevance of what they're doing is also really important for learners. And this is from another model, which is quite a practical model to apply. I'm going to address in another podcast. So, last but not least, next to psychological, social, and personal lenses, we can also explore learning from a neuro and cognition science perspective. Here concepts such as synaptic plasticity come into mind, which is the brain's ability to create new neuronal connections throughout life. So, for instance, there has been research into memory and learning disabilities such as dyslexia and ADHD, and they have measured brain activity to understand the differences in neurotypical and neuroatypical brains. A colleague of mine, for instance, he's undertaking research with dyslexic people, and he has identified that people with dyslexia initially need much longer to learn something new, and they need a much more sustained effort to learn something new than a neurotypical person. However, eventually they will have stronger neural networks and more complex neural networks, and particularly the connection between the left and the right brain hemisphere is much stronger than in neurotypical people. So hence dyslexic people quite often can think much more complex and networked and tend to be more creative than neurotypical people. So while learning disabilities, for instance, can come with their challenges, they also can come with their superpowers. And that's what I always try to explain to my students when they struggle. Just to summarize, we can look at learning through a psychological, personal, social, and neuro and cognition science lens. There are other disciplines and lenses we could use as well, such as educational philosophy or cultural education. However, at this junction, they don't have a direct influence to what we are exploring, and I won't address them at this moment. So I hope some of the examples were useful and you have a bit of a rough idea of how complex learning actually is and how complex understanding this whole process actually is. But I also hope it makes you see that there isn't really a right or wrong, and for a lot of things there isn't a panacea, but it's all about context and it's situational. And that we start, hopefully, a discussion in our community and practice and share experiences and maybe learn from one another and what works best in certain situations. And while we are doing this, I keep creating these podcasts and try and give you some more overarching frameworks and models and strategies you can use and try out in your own practice. So as usual, if you have any questions, post them to the forum, get in touch, send me an email, and I'll speak to you in the next podcast or in a one-to-one session.